Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Donnie Yance, who is the author of Adaptogens in Medical Herbalism, Elite Herbs and Natural Compounds for Mastering Stress, Aging, and Chronic Disease, and Herbal Medicine, Healing, and Cancer. This is a very complete book, it's a hardback, a large book with a lot of information in it. Donnie, thank you very much for joining us.
You are so welcome. Thank you very much for having me as well.
Would you like to give our listening audience a little bit about your background and how you got involved in herbalism?
Sure. I've been a practicing clinician for 30 years now, and I am both a clinical herbalist and a certified nutritionist, so I've kind of been able to blend both of a background in nutritional medicine and botanical medicine and weave those two things together, which I often call the dynamic duo, because doing everything you can with herbal medicine and not bringing the nutritional end is not going to get to where people need to be in their health. And so normally, and vice versa, just having your nutritional ends meet sometimes are not getting the complete package. And so I'd say that my exposure to herbal medicine started in the mid to later 1970s when I read an older book called Back to Eden, and that kind of triggered it touched my heart more than anything else. So thinking that our pharmacy is right before us, right out in our yards often, and in the cracks of the cities come these herbs that have tremendous healing capacity for us. And so that book touched my heart. I read it, and I started even back in the 70s as a teenager working in a natural food store. I worked in several natural food stores in the late 70s and managed a couple as well, and went on to live in a Franciscan monastery for a few years, ran a soup kitchen, and all of a sudden I was back in the natural food, actually owning a store in the mid-80s. And then that catapulted me to get as much education as I possibly could in the field of botanical and nutritional medicine, and then opening up a practice in the late 1980s in Connecticut at that time.
Well, one of the things that I've noticed with natural herbal medicine is that a lot of the masters of this have kind of a clairvoyant quality where they can go out and determine by just communing with nature what will treat what. And that was true of the Bach remedies and a lot of the herbalists that, you know, wrote the textbooks that are so, you know, that are classic. So it really combines with our, I guess, our intuitive sense about what will treat what.
Yeah. Well, medicine is fundamentally an art, and I think we've removed that aspect. We've tried to make medicine and fit a way that, you know, 1,000 doctors will do exactly the same thing over and over again based on a particular scan or a particular blood work that then gives them a diagnosis, then here's the treatment plan. So it's become very rudimental, very robotic. And as you said, traditional medicine, and I think all humans have the capacity to both take the intellect and take the knowledge, which is often modern and scientific, with the wisdom of traditional medicine, along with the musical quality and the mystical quality or the unknowing quality of intuition. But intuition without wisdom and knowledge is worthless, but often knowledge without wisdom and without some artistic ability is also, you can't figure everything out by the mind alone. And so often there has to be a convergency of the intellect, the mind working harmoniously with the heart through prayer and love rather than through fear and ego, which is also very prevalent in medicine. Often there's fear aspects going in as well as aspects around the ego. And so Daniel Bornstein said the greatest obstacle to making advances in medicine is not ignorance, but it's the illusion of knowledge. And I think that's very true today.
Yeah, I really love the story. You tell it in your book, and I've interviewed other authors that tell a similar story about how the Russians had a problem. You know, they had a problem because the extremes in Siberia were so damaging to the human body that they had to come up with the idea of adaptogens that would help the human, be able to work and do what they need to in Siberia. You want to tell that story? Because it's really interesting.
Yeah, I think that before, botanicals were looked at to support non-specifically health and help us withstand a diversity of stresses. They actually explored pharmaceuticals for a long time. Through the 1930s, 1940s, they worked with very low dosages of corticosteroids and mm-hmm. just, you know, would get one upside, but then also get two or three downsides whenever they did that. And then they started to explore some of what we call the great tonic herbs, most notably Panax ginseng as the first herb that was starting to get research, even as early as the 1940s. And yes, mm-hmm. it was to look at the harsh environment that people lived in, and also to both in the field of space, in the field of the armed forces, looking at people that lived on submarines, for example, for months and months, and giving them these plant extracts and seeing that their ability to overcome the stress of living underwater with no light or the impact that has on, say, our circadian rhythm and our endocrine system. And noticed by using plants that all of a sudden people had both better short-term response to the stress, but even more importantly, that the impact of stress from a standpoint of long-term health was also supported dramatically by these plants. And they went from Panax ginseng to the next plant that researched was an herb called Aralia manchurica, which was in the late 1950s. And then eventually mm-hmm. in the early 1960s, Eleutherococcus senecosis became the main focus of study, mostly because of the ability to grow it quickly. You know, there were large quantities of it, and the reliability of active constituents, and trying to find an herb or find a medicine that the masses could take without impacting the environment, that not being too costly. And that's kind of how Eleuthero got so studied in the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
So do you think that the Soviet military is still using these adaptogens?
I believe that they're still using them, yes. I know that they used them extensively in the late 1980s when they had their Olympic team won the most gold medals, I think 54, and I believe 88 it was, and then through the 90s. And yes, I do believe that they are still using them, but they aren't studying them like they did as much through the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Now the world has sort of embraced it, and you're seeing research come from all different areas of the world, including still Russia, but not certainly exclusively Russia. You see a lot of data now on some other plant compounds, whether it be ashwagandha, which is an Ayurvedic herb, Panax quinquefolia, which is our American ginseng. So, and then the other fact that I kind of embraced was, which is not as well known, is that often when you combine 2, 3, 4, 5 of these adaptogens, they together outperformed any single adaptogen. And so that's how I kind of got going with this concept of the harmonization of plant adaptogens, as well as combining often plant adaptogens, as I call them, as primary adaptogens, with some other herbs that don't have the sort of the endocrine restoration capacity of, say, Panax ginseng or Rapunctacum carthamoides, but they offer so much in the way of protection from, say, oxidative, inflammatory, and other adversary aspects of our environment and our aging process that are attributable to chronic disease. And So combining them with some herbs like turmeric, for example, or ginger, mm-hmm. or green tea, or grapeseed, all of a sudden you get this whole other benefit with the, what I call the primary adaptogen. So this package gets put together, and that's kind of that kind of sort of paved the way for sort of how my philosophy shifted, as well as the fact that I'm primarily a clinician. I'm a researcher, but I'm more than anything else a clinician, and have, you know, worked with patients now for 30 plus years, and so, and I specialize in cancer, and so seeing that the foundation to any protocol that I give, whether someone has advanced disease or someone's looking for preventative disease, it's still pretty much the same. How do we bolster the life force, you know, the true healing capacity within all of us, often in a non-specific way, often by normalizing, creating better efficiency, and so that our response is better, and then how do we further build the reservoir of energy within us? So that's kind of a common theme, not just for me, but of all traditional medicine, whether you study traditional Chinese medicine, the great medicines of America, actually, which were called the eclectic medicine, and then physiomedicalism or Ayurvedic medicine, they all have a common theme, that we have a life force, and that the first thing to do is cooperate with that life force and give it support, give it sustenance, and believe in it that with support, it has the capacity to dramatically contribute to healing, no matter what the disease state is.
Yeah, and we have some stressors now that we probably didn't have in the 1950s and 60s, specifically electromagnetic. There's a paper out of Japan that shows that patients with electromagnetic sensitivity have high levels of free radicals in their blood. And so mm-hmm. the secondary adaptogens that you were talking about are antioxidants. And it's well known that antioxidants will decrease free radical. So if you live in the city or if you live in a high-tech environment where you've got a lot of routers and other cell towers and all that sort of thing, and you're being bombarded with these energy fields that you really even can't see, what's going to happen is you're going to age faster. I mean, I take care of, we're in Atlanta, so I take care of a lot of pilots and flight attendants, and they're aging much more rapidly than they should because of this free radical problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they have higher incidence of various diseases as well. Also, the fact that very often they're working at nighttime, often when they should be sleeping, they're asked to do night flights, and that also impacts our capacity to eradicate free radical damage, because 100% of our protective mechanisms takes place when we're sleeping at night. So if you're not sleeping at night, you're basically not quenching your free radicals. I don't care what you take. Sleep is a primary component to how your body detoxifies. And primary adaptogens have tremendous redox antioxidant capacity in and of themselves. That's what people don't know. I mean, Shizandra, for example, which is a primary adaptogen, has better liver protective and kidney protective properties than even milk thistle does. And so the primary adaptogens are, in and of themselves, great protectors against the environmental stressors that we see, but fortifying them with some of these other plants, to me, only adds more to the picture. Rhodiola, for example, you know, the rosevins and cilindricides are tremendous scavengers of free radical damage in our body.
Yeah.
But possibly, you know, I, again, believe in the same thing. If we bathe our body with lots of phenolic compounds, with lots of isothiocyanates and, say, carotenoids, that, you know, each one of these groups of compounds offer different kinds of benefits, and that, again, giving them as a package is by far the best, because that's the way we traditionally have either consumed them in our diet or even taken them as medicine. You know, if you look at Chinese medicine or Ayurvedic medicine, formulas are no less than 5 plants and up to 15 or 20 plants. And then when we sit down and eat a great meal, a really healthy meal, we're getting all kinds of foods that are rich in protective compounds, but then we spice them up with herbs like sage and rosemary and ginger and garlic, and that just adds even further protection. And a lot of the culinary herbs that people traditionally have eaten around the world are some of the best medicines. You know, rosemary, tremendous medicinal plant, not just a plant that adds flavor to our food.
Yeah, that's probably an art form that is not really practiced too much now, about the medicinal quality of these herbs. I mean, in cooking, you know, but you don't hear about that too much. The flavor you do, but not the medicinal properties.
That's right. And I think that usage, you know, of these plants have been, again, traditional, and many of what we call the wonderful blue zones of the world, which offer the greatest health, you know, whether it be Sardinia, Icaria, Crete, Okinawa, you'll see their diets are not only rich in a lot of plant food, but they're also rich in a lot of herbs. And so, and I'm a big believer in, you know, just going around and seeing where do people live healthy around the world, and why are they healthy, and what aspects of their life can we bring back into our life and enrich our life with those. And so the common threads there are often dietary habits that you see constant. Then you'll see, obviously, they're all in rural areas. There's no city life. There's no doctors or big hospitals or modern medicine. They're often in strong family, religion, and community. And nobody does, quote unquote, exercise, but everybody's physically active, even at advanced ages. Even people in their 80s and 90s are still, you know, growing their own food, walking hills. And so I'm always looking at that and aspect of good health and saying, how can we bring that into our life and our life where we live? And so,
well, there's some information out there. I want to see if you agree with it, that with these adaptogens, it's good to take adaptogens that grow in the area that you live in. Like, it would be better for me to take American ginseng than Siberian ginseng. Do you agree with that?
No, not at all. That's theoretical. That's not really based on anything. I mean, it's nice when you can get a lot of your medicine locally, but it's certainly not necessarily better. Generally speaking, American ginseng, Panax quinquefolius, is considered a more cooling herb than, say, the other ginsengs. And so if you're going to isolate herbs and give them a single herb, American ginseng is considered an herb maybe more neutral and more suited for people that have a lot of outward energy but very little inward energy. So, you know, energy is a two-way street. So somebody, you know, John Smith says, oh, I got great energy, I don't need anything for energy. And then you do an assessment on John, and you say, yeah, all of your energy is output. You have nothing going inward. And so for that type of nourishment, you know, we're trying to get more inward nourishment, and you don't need any more external energy, often American ginseng is more suited for that kind of person. Where somebody else presents themselves with a lot of outward fatigue, sometimes the Asian ginseng, either the white or really with a lot of fatigue and particularly anemia, the red ginseng becomes more the herb that you want to do. And then there's some adaptogens that have, generally speaking, they're nonspecific, they have a normalizing effect, and they're non-toxic. But they all have a little bit of an affinity to do something maybe better for a certain organ system. For example, Schizandra seed is very good for liver. It's really rejuvenative and anabolic for liver health. Schizandra fruit is very restorative to the kidneys and lungs. And so sometimes you might feature that. Cordyceps is also very supportive to the kidney and lungs. And so sometimes just thinking in terms of neurologically speaking, rhodiola, and for the cardiovascular system, rhodiola might be good, but rhodiola is very drying And I don't think of a well-suited herb as a single herb at all for the masses because of its drying nature, that I believe it's much more suited to be combined with a lot of the other herbs. And so I don't think that that's necessarily true. And then some herbs might be better adjusting to cold weather as opposed to hot weather. So warming herbs, you want to take more going into the fall and winter. Herbs that might be a little bit cooling, more cooling from the hot summertime, you might want to emphasize those a little bit more to help quench, you know, help adapt more to heat. You know, are you adapting to cold? Are you adapting to heat? Or do you run very hot as a person, or do you run very cold as a person? So there are little subtle adjustments you can do individually from person to person to make it more specific. But generally speaking, you know, what makes adaptogens beautiful is that they're, you know, that they have non-specific effects, being that they can be used by everyone and can support anyone, whether they're hypofunctioning or hyperfunctioning. So you can, really, they have that normalizing effect.
I wanted to tell you a little story about roseola that is interesting. I have a patient population that is toxic from breast implants, either chemical toxicity or biotoxicity from mold. So they all have ADH deficiencies. So they drink and pee all the time. And nobody tests for roseola. Isn't that interesting? Nobody. It's like zero. You know, that's just not an herb that's going to be used in this population because everybody has this ADH deficiency. And, of course, they stay on the dehydrated side.
Yeah, and for that, normally, what I do energetically, that it means that they're very inward kidney essence depleted. And so adaptogens are good, but typically I'll combine the primary adaptogens with quite a bit of licorice, actually. Normally,
yeah, licorice is real good for them. Yeah,
if you add licorice to the primary adaptogens and then do kidney yin nourishment with herbs like Romania, and diastereo and say Shaktavaria with the licorice and primary adaptogens. And then what I do is dietary wise emphasize salt, naturally salty foods. I give them seaweed, usually a half to a teaspoon of seaweed powder or freshly harvested seaweed powder. And then lots of olives, salty olives, 5, 10, 15 a day. Just really naturally salty foods, feta cheese, and then all of a sudden they get enough salt, they get their herbs that strengthen their adrenal cortex, and then they nourish the kidney essence, and all of a sudden they start to hydrate again, and it's and their blood pressure comes up a little bit, and all of that improves.
Yeah, these women have a hypothalamic problem. They not only have an ADH deficiency, they have sex hormone issues, thyroid issues, and adrenal issues.
Yeah.
So you have to treat the whole thing. It's kind of complicated.
And that's what's beautiful.
Specifically, they have damage to the leptin receptors in the hypothalamus. That's really what it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And adaptogens are always going to help. They're always, to me, part of the foundation, part of the piece, because they basically nourish the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. They nourish the hub of the entire endocrine system. And the other piece more recently, even since I've written my book, that I'm spending more and more emphasis in my practice doing is now going over and nourishing the nervous system, which I did when it presented itself and it was obvious, but now I'm doing it just as part of the treatment plan because everybody's, you know, the nervous system and the endocrine system, you know, are linked together through the pituitary and the hypothalamus. And so if you only nourish the endocrine system and leave out the nervous system, you're still not getting to where you need to be. So I've been working with more what we call classic nervines, like Avena sativa, Scutellaria, Ziziphus seed, passion flower, Melissa, these herbs, and even Hypericum, St. John's wort, use a little bit of those herbs with the primary adaptogens, then with those kidney yin nourishing plants, and all of a sudden, everything starts working again. And you fix from the inside out. And so in other words, everyone's like going for, you know, various hormone replacement therapy, whether it be they think they need growth hormone, they think they need thyroid support. You keep trying to fix it, piecemeal it together from the outside. What really needs to happen is people need to be patient and nourish it from the inside out, which is this approach that I'm speaking to.
Yeah, my patients neurologically have GABA deficiency, so they are very anxious. And then if they're exposed to mold biotoxins and can't eliminate them, which is 25% of the population, they get these weird fasciculations and numbness and muscle weakness and actually end up in wheelchairs with a misdiagnosis of MS. They don't have MS. MS is an intracellular spirochete. It's one of these infections that affect the myelin sheath. But basically the neurotoxin that comes from the mold affects the entire body. But what's very interesting is that if the breast implant, say on the left side, is the only one that's affected, all the neurological symptoms are on one side. I'm not sure exactly why that is. It doesn't cross to the other side. It's very interesting.
Well, that's not that unusual because, like, when people get things like shingles, it's always on one side. So it's often I see neurological things being one side to the other. There's always a more vulnerable or weaker side, and so it seems to be
it must not get in the
bloodstream.
Yeah, it must not get in the bloodstream because if it did, it would go everywhere. But it must be distributed along the neurological system. But so because they have these mold biotoxins and their neurotoxins, they have severe problems with their neurological system, and they can't think and they can't remember, and they have a lot of trouble functioning.
And then the book that I wrote, obviously we're talking a lot about adaptogens, but my book is really a Bible book. And so there are chapters on all of the major chronic diseases. There is a chapter on neurological health. There is a chapter on cardiovascular health, which is extensive. I mean, there's almost 5,000 citations in the book. There's a chapter on thyroid health, a chapter on bone health, a chapter on diet, a chapter, you know, so there, I then take in each chapter how you combine adaptogens with the specific things you need to do on top of that. So when there is neurological issues, whether it be memory issues or whether it be actual issues that are manifesting like in an MS way, then I combine the primary adaptogens with all of the neuroprotective plants. Again, Hypericum or St. John's wort is probably at the highest of that list. I mean, there's not an herb that I know that is more nerve regenerative than St. John's wort. But other herbs, certainly saffron is very neuro regenerative and protective. Salvia metariza, Centella asiatica, which is Gotticola, Ginkgo biloba. I mean, ginkgo is such an amazing herb that it's the first substance in the world ever shown to actually pull Roundup toxicity out of the body. It is so powerful at pulling toxins out of the cell, is ginkgo. And baklava is the only known substance that can pull aluminum out of the brain. Baklava is the only. So these herbs are amazing, you know, and baklava also helps with people with GABAergic imbalances too. It has a very incredible ability to increase focus, concentration, yet still be relaxing at the same time.
So are you suggesting that if people have early dementia, they should use the baklava?
It's one of the herbs, yes. It's one of the primary herbs to be considering. It's probably the most scientifically researched and the most traditionally used. So you get it from both ends. You get tremendous research on baklava. But again, I don't do, you know, I do formulas. So I actually have my whole line of formulas, and I have one called Vibrant Mind, which is the formula I give predominantly for neurological support. And so baklava is the main herb in there, but there are obviously supportive verbs around there as well, which I've named. And then combining that with certain nutrients is also very advantageous too, whether it be acetyl L-carnitine, phosphatidylserine. You know, when you start to combine, again, certain key nutrients with key botanicals, that's when you can see some real shifts occur and positive shifts in people's neurological function. I've had two patients that were deemed Alzheimer's be reversed after they were diagnosed with Alzheimer's.
That's great. That's very good. So there's a couple of different causes of Alzheimer's that we've come across. One is prion disease, and the other is cyanobacter from bad fish. Which prion comes from bad meat. I don't know if I know that there's a chemical that gets concentrated in the brain with the cyano that probably some of your detox, your brain detox herbs would help with. And prions are, we're not sure. I mean, that might be the one where aluminum gets concentrated in the brain too, but those two need to be explored a lot more, because I think up to 75% of Americans may be exposed to prions. So, you know, we have to really look at that and get these neuroprotective formulas out there, because so many Americans are exposed to both sets of problems.
And it's another reason to consider, you know, again, doing several things together, because if 75% of the population is exposed to something, but only 10% gets it, so you have to say, well, that 10%, what is not working well in their body? And I'm sure there is some predisposition they have based in their gene presentation that doesn't detoxify certain things as well. They may have certain enzyme deficiencies that lend itself to not eliminating these things well. And so giving them support across the board so that all of those, you know, pumping mechanisms, all the ways that the body recognizes that it has disruptors, whether they be endocrine disruptors or neurological disruptors, all of the means that we use to activate what's called vitagenes, and that's what we're learning, again, plant compounds activate vitagenes, which then can upregulate things like heat shock proteins and chaperones in the cell that protect the neurons from these substances that otherwise would be, you know, causing them to undergo apoptosis and, you know, die prematurely and all of the other factors that would, you know, then lead to neurological dysfunction.
Yeah, one of the things that we're looking at is immune deficiencies, specifically because people have intracellular infections that affect their immune system. It could be HHV 6 with, you know, herpes affecting the T cells, could be mycoplasma, could be a number of different C pneumonia does it. There's a number of different intracellular infections, but they end up with an immune deficiency where they get a lot of yeast overgrowth and T cell problems. Of course, cancer is more common, and even prion disease may be more common. So, what would you offer patients with these T cell immune deficiencies?
Well, plants are excellent at improving immune function health, including primary adaptogens. But then I would combine them with herbs that may not be primary adaptogens, but very supportive immunologically to the body. I had mentioned cordyceps being one, of course, astragalus being a primary herb that supports T cell function. Of course, echinacea, and traditionally echinacea was combined more with baptisia, phytolacca, and thuya. So if it's viral origin, like a herpes virus, those herbs become very, very important. Thuya, phytolacca, baptisia, echinacea, licorice, I'm often combining those. You know, if it's bacterial, say like an H. pylori, a chronic H. pylori infection, then I do a little bit different things. And so there are common herbs that are non-specifically going to boost the immune surveillance, the health of the thymus gland or the spleen, all of the lymphatic system, like an herb like ceanothus. And then the key nutrient, the most important nutrient, which 80 to 90% of adults are deficient in, is zinc. You cannot have a healthy immune system. And what you'll find is people with low-grade chronic disease, like you're talking about, their immune, their T cells chew up all the zinc. They have no more zinc. And you can't have healthy T cells without zinc. It's impossible. Zinc is probably the most constant nutrient deficiency I see. I mean, everybody's kind of on to the need for vitamin D, but zinc is as important for health as vitamin D is, maybe even more important, and just as deficient as vitamin D is.
Yeah, we use something called zinc tally. You know, you don't want to have a zinc overdose because that can deplete copper and can lead to aneurysms. So you want zinc levels to be monitored. Zinc tally tastes like water as long as you have a zinc deficiency. But when you start to come up to normal zinc levels, it tastes like a little metallic. So it lets you know. But I agree. A lot of my patients muscle test for zinc. But I don't like to just put them on zinc and leave them on it. I think you have to be careful with that.
Yeah, I there are circumstances where you do, especially if you're initially doing high dose. I do both. I've done zinc challenge testing, but I now do predominantly both blood level zinc and then red blood cell level of zinc. And then I always test copper with zinc because they do have a relationship. And most of the time people have copper excess, and then you look at the ceruloplasm, which is the tissue level of copper, not just the blood level of copper. So ceruloplasm is very reflective of the tissue storage of copper. And you'll see in cancer patients, predominantly they have high copper, high ceruloplasm, and low zinc across the board. And copper is a very important nutrient to cancer progression. So most of the known growth factors like transforming growth factor beta, basic fibroblast growth factor, vascular endothelial growth factor are copper dependent. And so often if you lower the copper level, bring up the zinc level, then you're doing a whole slew of things that are beneficial to the patient, not just restoring their immune system, but you're antagonizing the copper that is the tumor is sequestering for growth and invasion.
Right, yeah, that's true.
And that's part of what I call, there's always three areas that I work on with the patient. One is the energetic patient, which is what's presented subjectively through my relationship with them, the symptoms they present. Then, and that's what I call boasting the host or the person. The second is the microenvironment, which is how we do and analyze all of the various blood and urine tests that we might run, which is including zinc, copper, ceruloplasm, fibrinolytic pathways like fibrinogen and D-dimer, plasminogen activator inhibitor, galectin-3 and TGF-beta. That's all part of the microenvironment assessment. And then we do an assessment on the tumor, understanding the phenotype of the tumor, and that's done through protein expression, molecular profiling, and you start to put the pieces together based on how each one of those lenses are applied and then layered, and then the toolboxes are all brought in and converge on strengthening the host, the person, altering the microenvironment to be the most conducive to the host, the least conducive to disease, and then targeting the disease as well. That's kind of my what I call the ETMS approach, which is the eclectic triphasic medical system. It's the integrative model that I have been formulating.
There are some specific herbs that are specifically anti-cancer herbs, like Graviola and Artemisian, and these herbs. Do you use these in your formulas?
Yes. Artemisinin is a sesquiterpene lactone derived from Artemisia annua, which has 9 sesquiterpene lactones in the plant itself, as well as flavonoids that all present themselves as a synergistic cancer-suppressing plant. So Mm-hmm. Artemisinin by itself is good and important, and there needs to be, it's dose sensitive, but artemisinin is far superior when it's combined with the other plant compounds along with it. And so what we do is take 150 milligrams of pure artemisinin and combine it with 100 milligrams of Artemisia annua extract at 8 to 1 with a chelidonium or celandine extract with 2% alkaloids, with a burdock seed extract and a red clover extract. And so that's how our Artemisian formula works. And then typically artemisinin, if the tumor is highly hypoxic, then artemisinin isn't going to work that well, or if the patient's very anemic. And so the patient cannot be anemic, iron anemic, and you need to perfuse more oxygen and blood flow with at the same time you use the Artemisia protocols, I call it, and you always cycle that 1 week on and 1 week off. And there are numerous mechanisms by which artemisinin or artemisia suppresses cancer, and it can be quite miraculous. It's I've never seen anything work like it in all my years of working with cancer. And one of the main mechanisms is that cancer cells differentiate themselves from healthy cells by having an abundance of transferrin receptors or iron binding receptors. They need more iron. They need more sugar.
Right.
They need, you know, more copper. There's certain things that those cells need more of. And so the artemisinin basically has an affinity for the transferrin receptor. It actually attaches
blocks
to the receptor and then blasts the cell by oxidizing the iron inside the cell. So it's basically an oxidative stressor to that cell.
Wow.
And if you combine it, if you combine it with blood and oxygenating herbs, and then you use what I use is a nitric oxide dilating formula as well, with citrulline, and citrulline basically activates peripheral vasodilation, and plus it is a big booster to natural killer cells, and then butyric acid, those all things work synergistically with Artemis, and I typically do 1 week on and then 1 week with a different protocol. You don't ever give it continuously. It should always be intermittently. And then you mentioned graviola. Graviola is the same plant as pawpaw, and the compounds in graviola are called acetogenins, and there's over 50 of them, and they are cytotoxic compounds, actually, and so it is one of the plants that actually does offer some chemotherapeutic-like effects in it. You know, I use the Pacific yew tree, which has the taxines in it. I use the Madagascar periwinkle plant, which is where the vincristin, vinblastin, vinirubin all come from. Actually, four different chemo drugs come from that one plant. Four drugs.
Wow.
And mayapple, which is the root herb for the drug etoposide or BP16. Obviously, the taxine coming from the Pacific yew is the source for the drug Taxol, Taxotere,
right,
which is a semi-synthetic of Taxol, and then now Abraxane. And there's other taxines now. There's another taxine approved for prostate cancer. And so I like to combine the whole plant extract if a patient is actually going on that cytotoxic agent, because they have... The cancer cells have pumping mechanisms, and that even if the drug works initially pretty well, the surviving cancer drugs are figuring out ways to pump that drug out. And if you combine it with the whole herb offers mechanisms that actually inhibit multi-drug resistance to the chemotherapeutic drug.
Yeah, that's very true. You mentioned red clover in your formula. It's well known that cancer patients are hypercoagulable. So that is that why the red clover is put in?
No, red clover has lots of benefits, but there are coumarins in red clover that are inhibitory to thrombosis. And I've written several papers on cancer and thrombosis and the connection, and that's why it's important all cancer patients get tested for D-dimer, fibrinogen, and other markers of thrombosis, but those two tend to be the two best. And a lot of blood-moving herbs I combine, mm-hmm. almost the herbs that I talked about, saffron, salvia. Saffron is an amazing inhibitor of thrombosis. Salvia, ginkgo, and then if you combine those with enzymes, and the most specific enzyme in cancer that I use when people are very high risk is the earthworm-derived enzyme called lumbrokinase. Bromelain is also useful as well as an anti-fibrolytic mm-hmm. compound, but the best is lumbrokinase. Other enzymes are useful but not as effective in cancer-related thrombosis, because if the cancer is inducing the thrombosis or that kind of state, then those are the things that work, the botanicals combined with the lumbrokinase enzyme. And then, of course, some nutrients like ambiquinol and biquinone are useful as well. Fatty acids are useful, too.
Right.
And inhibiting that, too.
Well, I once did a five-hour surgery on a naturopath who unfortunately stayed on red clover, not knowing that she should stop it. And for 5 hours, I never saw a clot form. We were very lucky in that the drains worked, and so she didn't get a blood clot or didn't, you know, I guess I told her to stop it afterwards when I asked her why she didn't clot. But you definitely don't want to be on red clover and have surgery.
Mm-hmm. Why was she taking red clover?
I'm not sure. She was a naturopath, so I guess she had a reason.
Right.
But, maybe she had a family history of clotting or something that she was trying to prevent, but didn't realize that she needed to stop it before surgery. Usually you would think a naturopath would know to do that, but she didn't. Well, we're coming up on the end of our hour. Would you like to give your contact information?
Sure. So I have a weekly blog that I do and a website myself, which is just DonnieYance.com. It's DonnieYance.com. And that is my one outreach that I do to the world, as I say, all kinds of things on from spirituality to herbs, specifically to different conditions, to topics, to recipes. I do a lot of recipes, post recipes as well. And then I have my foundation. It's called Mederi Foundation, M-E-D-E-R-I, foundation.org. And everything I do as a clinician is underneath this nonprofit foundation, of which I have my clinic, and then which is called Mederi Center for Natural Healing. And then we have a research wing, and we're about to start an advanced breast cancer research project with Ohio State University. And I'm looking to do research with other large institutions around the country. And then we have an education wing that I teach and train practitioners from around the world. And then I have my product company, which is called Natura Health Products, and that's N-A-T-U-R-A healthproducts.com. And those are the three websites that people can sort of access information about me and the various things that I'm involved in.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I do want to say that this book is like a encyclopedia Bible of herbal medicine. It's not just on adaptogens. And like Donnie said, there's a chapter on most medical conditions, including cancer and all the other things that he mentioned before. So it's really, really useful for anybody who's interested in natural medicine.
And the whole back of the book is all what I call monographs on both. There's 65 to 70 monographs in the back. 50 of them are botanical monographs, and the rest of them are all nutritional compounds, which I call companions to the adaptogens. And some of them are amino acids like creatine, for example. But the monographs in and of themselves are really wonderful ways to look something up. Say you want to look up rhodiola and want to know about it. They're very extensive monographs, and so that's the whole back third of the book as well.
Yeah, that is very useful when you're trying to learn about a particular herb or something. Great. Well, thanks so much, Donnie, for joining us.
You're so welcome. It's been my pleasure. I've had a very wonderful time.
All righty. Well, this is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show. Please join us next week.